Illinois has lost thousands of manufacturing jobs this year and continues to struggle maintaining business.
Certainly, Illinois is doing worse than Michigan and Indiana and Ohio. And that is something that the Illinois Manufacturers Association has been sounding the alarm on.
That's Crane's Chicago business manufacturing reporter Claire Bushy. We talk to her and check in with how one small central Illinois town has turned to tourism to help replace manufacturing jobs. Plus, as we're weeks away again from being without a state budget, we talked to the documentary film team behind a new video series that's chronicling how the budget crisis is affecting students, families, and workers in Illinois.
Over half of our clinical staff got laid off. So that's hundreds of kids that aren't getting services now.
That's Jackie Wallen, a counselor at Youth Crossroads in Berwyn, Illinois, talking to Stranded by the State. And that's a collaboration between Cartemquin Films and In These Times. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Illinois has lost nearly 8,000 manufacturing jobs this year. This is the second year in a row that Illinois has lost the most manufacturing jobs in the Midwestern region. We're going to talk about that a little bit on the 21st today, and specifically what small towns do when the major employer in its area packs up and leaves. Later on, we're also going to be having a conversation with Crane's Chicago business manufacturing reporter Claire Bushy about sort of how manufacturing is doing throughout the state. But we wanted to start with the town of Casey, Illinois. The small East Central Illinois town has about less than 3,000 residents. When two manufacturing plants left the area in 2007, the economic impact was devastating. But 4 years after that, one idea has helped turn the town's economy around as they turn to tourism. We're joined on the phone now by Jim Bolin, who helped Casey tap into the tourism market. Jim, thanks for joining us on the 21st. Welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you for asking.
Jim, maybe you can start by taking me back to 2007. You're a businessman in Casey. What was it like when those two manufacturing plants left?
Well, it was, you've seen a lot of families scratching their head trying to figure out what they're going to do next. We're a town of 3,000, and I believe the numbers was close to 350 to 400 jobs left. In them
wow.
2 years, and
yeah.
that's just was devastating for the community and the families.
And how did you come up with an idea of this? How did you come up with the idea that we need to be thinking about maybe looking at different industries, attracting people to come visit you guys?
Well, it's really by default, I guess. My family and I, we aren't take vacations, and we stop at unique places and notice different things. And we was in a town out in Denver, Colorado, and my wife and daughter, we went to a little tea shop in a small town, and they really liked that tea shop and liked to bring that experience back to Casey. And I said, well, that would be awesome to do that. But, you know, with a town of 3,000, we would just be fighting over the same customers. So, I said, let's, if we're going to do this, let's try to think of a niche to get us, some people off the interstate. And, we have a family pipelining business where we work on pipelines and maintenance. So we were familiar with pipes. So, and I have wind chimes at home because they bring back fond memories, so I was listening to my wind chimes one night, and I just wondered what the world's largest wind chime was. So looked it up, and being a pipeline company, I said, well, we can top that. So we built a wind chime, put it by our tea shop, and opened them up, and we seen the traffic that was coming off the interstate.
Right, so this is I-70, right? And your wind chime,
correct.
Can you
yeah.
describe, I like how you've described the wind chime, but you haven't said how big it is. How large is this wind chime that you built? Your company is Bolin Enterprise LLC, but how this wind chime is actually not, it's not really small, is it?
Right, yeah. The world's largest wind chime before ours was, the longest tube on it was 27 foot long. The longest tube on our wind chime is 42 foot long, and with the framing that holds the wind chime and everything, it's 54 foot tall in the air.
54. So that's more than four stories, really. We're thinking.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So we tweeted out a picture because we want everyone to see this. If you follow 21ST show, you can see the picture of the world's largest wind chime. So, Jim, I imagine you thought we need to get Guinness World Records involved with this. That's always something that helps kind of have that title on there. How did you go about doing that?
Well, the first attempt was a wind chime, and we just looked up on the website and followed the instructions. We got a registration number to register it, and then they've got it step by step on the web, and we followed through with it. And the economic development person for Casey at that time helped me step through that, and we got it certified through Guinness, and I think it was May or November of 2011, I believe it was. But the crowd just kept coming, and that's when the switch kind of flipped in my head and thought, well, hey, we could probably do something here to help our small town.
How many people do you think have come to the town to visit? I don't know if you guys keep official records or what you've seen.
Well, in the state of Illinois, you have to have a guest book, and you have to obtain at least 5,000 signatures before you can get an attraction sign put on the interstate. So we put our guest book out the spring of that next year, 2012, and I'd say within probably 3 months, we had our 5,000 signatures. So we applied for the attraction signs for the interstate, and this last year, of course, that was 5 years ago, this last year, on Thursday, Fridays, and Saturdays, we're estimating between 500 to 700 people a day come through and look at the eight world largest or the Guinness Book records that we have in our town.
Wow. So before we get to the people and the economic impact of that, let's talk about all of the. So you have the world's largest wind chime. Can you tell me a little bit about the other world's largest items that you guys have come up with?
Yeah, the next one in line was the world's largest golf tee, because one of the guys that is the president of the golf course was trying to think of an idea to help, you know, piggyback on the thing. So we thought of the golf tee, and so we built a golf tee, which is 30 foot tall. It's 6 foot across the top. It weighs 6,659 pounds, and it's solid wood.
And so did you build all of that in Casey?
Yeah, right here at our shop. So we just work on them when our work slows down and we have an opportunity to work on it. We'll pull them out of the corner and dust them off and work on them for a little while. And then when we get busy, we put them back. But yeah, the next one after that would have been the knitting needle and a crochet hook, which I love to chainsaw carve as a hobby, as a passion, and that's how we made the first second, third, and fourth one was that. And then after that was the rocking chair, which is 56 foot tall. It weighs about 48,600 pounds, and it sits across the road from the wind chime, and it's just a couple feet taller than it. So it's pretty massive.
And you actually had to crochet something with the crochet hooks to qualify for the world record, right?
Yeah, we have a little shop in town called the Yarn Studio. And Jeanette Huizenge runs it, so I made them and give them to her, and then she knitted a swath, and we videoed it and sent it into Guinness Book and got the world record on it.
And I wanted to bring someone else into the conversation, and it's Dave Liebenau, because inside he's the owner of Casey's Candy Depot. And inside Casey's Candy Depot is the world's largest wooden shoes. Hey, Dave, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, how did the world's largest wooden shoes end up inside your candy store?
Well, that's a story in itself. But Jim was taking me around showing his vision of all the items that he had built and was continuing to build, and took me into this building that was in the process of being restored by Jim and his team, and he had mentioned to me that he wanted to put the wooden shoes in here, and I said, oh, that's nice, and he said, I think an antique store would be great here, and I said, Jim, we really don't need another antique store. How about a candy store? And at the time, I wasn't thinking of doing it myself, because I was also working with another business here. My wife's family has a business here in town and was working for them. But the more I thought about it and the more I really saw Jim's vision and really understand tourism and the importance of tourism and how it can have a real positive economic impact on an area, I decided maybe it was my turn to do this. And something I've always wanted to do was have my own retail store. And so I decided to jump in with both feet and do it. And it's been great. And having the wooden shoes is a great draw for the store. And you know, Jim and his team did a wonderful job building those shoes because they're huge.
How big are the shoes, Jim?
They're 12 foot long, 5 foot wide and 5 foot tall, and they weigh about 2,500 pounds apiece. And they're big, and they're pretty. The guy's done a real good job finishing up. And Dave's store sits right behind the world's largest mailbox, which is 32 foot tall. Japan had the world's largest mailbox before the United States. We got it back here in the United States, and theirs held 2,300 cubic feet of mail, and the one in front of Dave's store there holds 5,800 cubic feet of mail.
Oh, right, because you can actually, it is a working mailbox, you can actually climb up the stairs, right? It's about four flights of stairs you climb up to put mail in that mailbox. Jim, let me ask you something, because Dave was talking about your vision. In 2014, the town of Kesey set out a comprehensive plan to work on economic growth. You were on the committee. And you said that one of the findings was that the town had, you know, and I think this happens with a lot of places where they've had decades or centuries of work of manufacturing and factories, and that's just been so much part of the culture of the town. How hard was it for people in Kesey to think about investing in tourism, or even just to get everybody on idea with your vision of, hey, we can bring people here? One thing we do have is we're at a crossroads between Indianapolis. Like, lots of people are coming by on 70. Maybe we can get them to stop here like I did when I was traveling. How hard was it to get everybody on board with that?
It's kind of difficult to get people out of the old mindset of that. And the thing about tourism and the town, you know, you have to have a lot of entrepreneurship, and Dave's a prime example of that. He went out and invested in his idea, and it's worked out well for him. So, getting people to switch gears is was pretty tough, you know. And it's
how many years do you think
thing,
it took? But, yeah, how many years do you think it took before people started thinking, hey, maybe this is making a difference?
I think after the beginning of the third year of down this path, I think people started seeing the opportunities that was showing themselves around Kesey. Yeah,
Dave, what do you think?
I agree. I think, in fact, I think this past year has been, you know, every year since Jim's introduced the big items, we've seen a huge bump in tourism and the numbers just coming into town here. They're even still coming in today, which is amazing because, you know, typically tourism is during a summer season, basically. But even today when it's, you know, 32 degrees here, we still have people coming in the door that are stopping off the interstate because they saw a sign for a world's largest wind chime and didn't realize that we had seven other items here. And what they thought was a 20-minute stop turned into an hour and a half or 2 hours, and they're loving it.
And how much candy did they buy? And they bought some candy, right, Dave?
Candy and all the other things that we have to offer here too. But that's just—it's just been phenomenal to watch. And just I opened up in May, and I've way exceeded my business plan.
What was your business plan? What did you think? What did you think would happen?
Well, I'm actually in what was going to be my year one plan. I'm actually going to hit my year three plan, which is basically triple what I forecasted for the year one.
And is that for business, for sales?
Yes, that's for sales.
Okay.
And so it's just so I expanded my store immediately to there's a second floor in my store, which I was not going to do for another year, and I went and did it right away, and it's paying off. And And Jim, you know, it's not only about the big things, it's how they're presented is also a real key factor. These are not just a rocking chair sitting in a parking lot. It's in a setting that is unbelievable with landscaping and the way it's presented and the way it's they're just a work of art in particular. Every one of the items that Jim and his team have put together, even in front of my store, I have a railroad theme, and they have, between landscaping and decorations and all that, have put railroad tracks in front of the store and have added a caboose and a flat car. So it's just how the whole thing is presented is really what's impressive to our visitors.
Well, and I think if, especially when you're talking about the presentation, Dave, I can imagine that lots of people are coming and there were social media, people taking pictures, sitting in the chair, posting mail. Do you feel like that helps keep the word out? Do you guys keep track of that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just my Facebook alone has over 2,000 followers. And that's within the last, you know, 5 months, 6 months. So social media has been a huge help through this. And I think it's, you know, every year it's more than double. And I can only imagine what this next summer will bring to the area. And I think, you know, when you were asking about people, if they're catching on or whatever, I'm sure they were hesitant at first. But I believe now they're seeing the benefit of it. And I think we're finding more local people wanting to invest in this community and opening up new shops. And so there have been new shops that have opened, and there's future ones coming next year. So
we're going to have to take a break. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I just want to wrap up this conversation with you guys, hear a little bit more about other opportunities, other business development that's happening in Casey. We're talking about Casey, Illinois, and tourism there. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the East Central Illinois town of Casey, Illinois. They've got about 3,000 residents. We're talking about how they've turned to world's biggest items, to tourism, to help bring visitors to their town, especially after they've had two big manufacturing plants that have closed in the past decade. I'm talking to Jim Bolin, who is the president of Bolin Enterprises. He was on the Casey Comprehensive Plan Committee. It was his vision for these big things for their small town. Dave Liebenau is with us as well. He's the owner of Casey's Candy Depot, which is also home to the world's largest pair of wooden clogs. Dave, boy, you were right. Everybody's tweeting to 21st Show all of the pictures right now that they've taken in your town of the big items. So I know social media really does, I think, help you guys in terms of getting the word out. Do you feel like, and Jim, I guess one of the things is you probably are trying to do both kind of the old school of people just driving on a highway, seeing those attraction signs and new social media. Do you feel like, are you trying to do any particular other outreach or marketing to get the word out about what you all have in Casey, Jim?
Well, the things that, like Dave said, is the social media. You know, we got trip advisors and all kinds of that kind of thing going out there. What's really helped us this last year, and it's really going to help us next year. We was featured in the 2017 Guinness Book, so 7 of our 8 items are pictured on page 100 in that book, and that's really brought, you know, because they put out worldwide commercials about the Guinness Book, and featured some of their commercials with us, and that's just brought a huge amount of people coming through. So,
Dave, just before the break, you were talking about how it's taken a couple of years. You all started this. Jim, you started this, what, back in 2011? It sounds like 2012 you really started working on all of this?
Right. Well, we put our first item out in 2011. We started on it 2 years before that. Mm-hmm. Building. But yeah.
Dave, how do you think, I'm curious, you were saying, if we're looking at, you have a candy store, what other small businesses, what does it mean for Casey in terms of other small businesses that have now also sprung up around these attractions?
Well, that's what's making these businesses spring up. That's why I entered into this market, was looking at what the impact has been over the last couple of years with Jim's, with the big things coming up and the increase in traffic coming into this town. And so you see the opportunity. And even those existing businesses that have been here over the last 5-10 years have also seen huge growth because of this. So I think it's waking people up, and they're seeing the traffic, they're seeing the opportunity. There's empty buildings here that people are buying and fixing up and opening up their businesses. I think it's going to continue, and as Jim adds more items, which there are more things on the docket, so to speak, we tell our visitors here, you got to come back because there's more new stuff coming. And I think that's the other thing, is this is not just a one-time visit. These people will be coming back over and over again, and that's a huge benefit for us.
Jim, we just have about a minute left, but I wonder what you would say to another community that's looking for, that's been in this, where you guys have been, and maybe looking for advice about how to change their town.
Well, the big thing is, no pun intended, but is, you know, small communities, we can't compete against the bigger town that can offer tax savings and, different things to entice them to come to their town. You know, small towns just can't compete against that. So that's why we looked outside of that. And you just got to brand yourself as a different thing. And we've branded ourselves as a small town, to where you can we're on the theme of a small town. You can bring your family. You can spend no money at all and go around and see the sights and walk the town and enjoy and set and visit. Or you can come and spend and eat and buy some things at the store and leave with a bag full of candy. So
yeah, thanks for that. Thanks for that. I want to thank Jim. I want to thank Jim Bolin and Dave Libenow for joining us from KZ. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Appreciate you calling.
Let's get some more context now from Claire Bushy. She's the Illinois manufacturing reporter for Crane Chicago Business. We spoke with her earlier from Chicago. Claire, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
We've been talking about how some towns are adjusting to losing manufacturing plants. That's something, of course, that's been going on for decades throughout Illinois. But just like a couple weeks ago in late October, you reported on two manufacturing plants that left Illinois from Wisconsin. What was the reason for these two plants leaving?
Well, it was different in each case, but certainly a large factor for both was Wisconsin rolled out the welcome mat. They gave both of them generous tax incentive packages, so that certainly didn't hurt.
Mm-hmm. And how much of did they say the fact that how much was Illinois' fiscal climate, workers' compensation, how many of those issues were cited by those companies when they left?
You know, it was a little bit different for each one. Colbert Packaging, which is one of the main suppliers for the Frango mint boxes, The owner of that company said that the overall fiscal climate and somewhat zooey atmosphere for Illinois contributed to him wanting to move. But actually, on the specific issue of workers' comp, he said that that was not a main factor. It was maybe like 1-2% of his overall decision.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came to Vanco products, again, you know, workers' comp was not like by any means a deciding factor. It was sort of icing on the cake that his insurance would go down as well. But for him, actually, he had looked at sites in Illinois. He had wanted to grow at their current site in Lake Villa, but they weren't able to do it because of construction issues. So they looked in McHenry County, they looked elsewhere in Lake County, and in the end, Wisconsin put together a better deal. But they wanted to actually keep all their workers in Illinois, and so that's why they're in Wisconsin now, but they're just on the other side of the border.
Mm-hmm. So their workers can stay, right?
Exactly. Because
that's a big disruption. So, Claire, we're looking at what? Like 10,000 manufacturing jobs lost in the past 12 months. How much of that is because of factories closing down, and how much of that is issues like, what would you say are the biggest issues for manufacturers in the state of Illinois for staying open?
Well, I think that it's largely due to macroeconomic forces. And the 10,000 jobs you're talking about, Caterpillar is laying off that many people across their operations.
Mm-hmm.
Caterpillar can't sell as much of their equipment if commodity prices are in the tank because their customers are not digging as many things out of the ground. I think it's hard to argue that that is necessarily based on things happening specifically in Illinois. Same thing when it comes to Deere has been laying people off. And again, that's because their customers aren't buying as much of their equipment because prices for crops are not doing as well. And so therefore farmers are holding on to their equipment for longer and less likely to buy new.
So just when we're thinking about workers' comp, you know, it's something obviously Governor Rauner has talked a lot about. You hear the Illinois Manufacturers Association has made this. You hear over and over again how important reform of workers' comp is. What exactly do manufacturers want?
Well, manufacturers want their insurance rates to go down, but they actually have been going down for 20 years, which is the part that I think always gets left out of this conversation. They have not gone down as much as they have, though, in the rest of the nation. And there are a lot of people who would argue that that is because we're engaged as a country in a race to the bottom to undercut protections for workers, and that Illinois is more of a holdout in terms of still offering a level of benefit that is not available to workers, say, just over the line in Indiana.
Or Wisconsin.
And Indiana stands out because it has some of the lowest workers' compensation rates in the country.
Okay.
So manufacturers would like that to be less expensive.
And as you say, it's gone down over the past 20 years. How much, and I don't know, how much does this actually cost companies? How significant a cost is this?
So I think it's in Illinois, $1.87 per $100 of payroll. And in Indiana, I want to say it's like 106.
Oh, so that's a pretty significant difference then.
Oh yeah, it's a large difference. The question is, you know, what do you define as sufficient for the people who actually work and the people who actually might, you know, lose a thumb because it's cut off.
So I wanted to ask Claire, when you're talking about macroeconomic forces, obviously there's, there's the global economy, as you're talking about, especially sales for Deere and Caterpillar, those multinational companies. But what are we looking at in terms of Illinois? How much is Illinois losing jobs compared to other manufacturing in the Midwest?
Yes, certainly Illinois is doing worse than Michigan and Indiana and Ohio. And that is something that the Illinois Manufacturers Association has been sounding the alarm on. And they partly that is because the things that we make in Illinois are different from some of those states. The auto industry has been doing very well since they came out of the recession. And we have some of that work in Illinois, but we don't have as much of it as some of our Midwestern neighbors. And so we're a little bit different in terms of how we fare. But
why is that?
Because a large part of what we make is machinery and equipment, such Caterpillar and Deere being the two big ones.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you think overall, like especially when we're talking about Caterpillar, you were mentioning Caterpillar struggling this year. Now, I also know that their stocks got a little bit of boost after the election of Donald Trump, who's been talking about increasing infrastructure spending across the country. Of course, we had news last week of his intervention in Indiana, keeping 1,000 jobs at one air conditioning at Carrier, a heating and air conditioning company, cooling company in Indiana. Do you think the picture for Illinois' manufacturing plants has actually gotten a little brighter with the election of Donald Trump being the next president?
Certainly, Cat's and Deere stock have gone up. They're doing very well at the moment, better than they've done in a while. And infrastructure, a big infrastructure package would be very good for Cat and good for Deere as well. And how that actually gets put together by the new administration and if it in fact comes together, because the President-elect Trump has talked about doing that as like a public-private partnership in which private entities would actually put up the money in exchange for tax credits. So whether it actually all comes together remains to be seen. But certainly if we're going to start heavily investing in infrastructure, that would be good for two big companies in Illinois.
Claire, earlier we were talking about how one town was handled the loss of its local manufacturing employers. And if you're just joining our conversation, we were talking to residents in Casey, Illinois, where they've worked on being a tourism draw, drawing in people with the Guinness World Records for the world's largest items, which is, I think, a unique case for maybe an old manufacturing town. I wonder how you're seeing other small towns deal with situations like this where the main employer leaves town. What have you seen across Illinois?
I have not seen as many creative responses to that as you probably have.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really hard to replace.
Well, because... right. And I'm even, what about the Chicago suburbs? I mean, because I know that when you think about different suburbs in the Chicago area and you look at how suburbs are also, I mean, suburbs even are competing with other suburbs for these jobs, right? I mean, how are you seeing different local governments handle this?
Well, I see more of people trying to retrain for the manufacturing that we actually still do have here, and people more of an emphasis on CNC machining and training people to be able to have jobs that are reflect more the more technological side that has become important in manufacturing. There's an excellent operation in Skokie, for example, called Symbol Training Institute that works on trying to get people with the skills that they actually need to fill the jobs that manufacturers do still have available here.
And do you think that one thing you often hear from manufacturing employers is the need for folks to have CNC training, the need for looking for skilled workers at that kind of medium level, workers who are good, have proficient enough math and science skills to go into learning advanced manufacturing technology? Are we still seeing a gap in that? Are we still not seeing enough of those workers in Illinois?
Certainly, that's what manufacturers are telling me. There's a gap in what the skills that people have and people wanting to actually go into manufacturing jobs. And so there's fewer people entering the industries. And so they are having a hard time actually filling some of those jobs because people don't really seem to want to take them, and then you have you don't have people entering the pipeline. And so, there's definitely still a gap.
Right. There's just sort of the skills mismatch. And I guess my last question is really then, do you feel especially when we're thinking about manufacturing, we're thinking about sort of the old manufacturing workers and sort of new manufacturing. Do you really feel like when we're talking about manufacturing, this is almost a case of two Illinois, whether it's advanced manufacturing or those people who don't have those skills or the jobs that are in Chicago versus the rest of the state? Do you think that's an accurate description?
Yes, I think it is. And I'm not exactly sure what the solution is, but I think it's definitely a problem that the state is facing.
Claire Bushey covers Illinois manufacturing for Crane Chicago Business, joining us from Chicago. Claire, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stay tuned. Coming up next, we're going to continue to talk about the economy, about the state budget. A new web series that's looking at people impacted by the fiscal crisis is called Stranded by the State. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Will be unable to continue payments to nonprofits and social services.
Illinois has been without a budget since July 1st of last year.
This is uncharted territory. Truly, for any state in the union, never has gone a full year without a budget.
We have not received any money.
Has the state done an adequate review of the consequences of the budget crisis? Do you have a real grasp of what's facing the families?
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and that was a little bit from Stranded by the State. It's a new web series that looks into the impact of the ongoing state budget impasse here in Illinois, whether that's affecting public education at the university level, people working with at-risk youth, senior or housing programs. It's a collaboration between the Chicago-based documentary production company Kartemquin Films. They worked with In These Times. It's a Chicago-based magazine that describes itself as offering news from the progressive left, to produce the 8-episode series, which is debuting every week online. Online with us from Chicago is Liz Carr. She's the director and producer of Stranded by the State. Also joining us from Chicago is Gordon Quinn. He's the founder and artistic director of Kartemquin. Gordon, Liz, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you.
Liz, you've been working on this project for more than 5 months, talking to people from different, not just social service agencies, but students, workers, people all across the state of Illinois. What prompted this project? Why did you want to do this?
Right. In These Times and myself, we were talking for a long time about doing a project together. And, you know, with the whole budget crisis happening and really seeing how it's affecting the most vulnerable people of Illinois, we were like, this is a great opportunity to tell this story. And, you know, In These Times and Kartemquin have a lot in common. And, you know, it was a great partnership to embark on.
Gordon, why did you want Kartemquin involved with this?
Well, you know, we have always been interested in seeing the consequences of social policy and government in people's lives. How do these things actually play out? So this was a great opportunity. You know, we had been working with Liz on many projects over the years, one of which was Hard Earned, about low-wage work, or the series we did for Al Jazeera America. And so this just seemed like the ideal project. The other thing that's exciting about it is that these are short films, and they're going up on the web very quickly. So doing something a little bit different for us, something that's very timely and using the short media format, was a challenge that we've been wanting to take on. And we think what's happening to people in terms of the state, because there is no budget, I mean, it really resonates with the conversation you were just having about manufacturing in Illinois and some of the programs that are being impacted by this state budget crisis are the programs that people need to get trained to take these manufacturing jobs that are out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when we think about that, it's interesting to me about the format of this. And Liz, I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit, because they're about 7 minutes each. They're online. Are you hoping that format, because it's and you're sort of capturing little snapshots. The first one was about public education. The second one about this one program that works with at-risk youth. Are you hoping that these will get widely shared? Maybe this is a different way around talking about the state budget impasse?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what's great about the web series is it kind of lends itself to outreach and engagement right in the kind of actual thing itself and the mode of distribution. You know, with Kartemquin, we do a lot of times, we make a film about a social issue, and we spend a lot of time also trying to get it into communities where it can affect social change. And I think what's exciting about this format is it really is part of the process. And you know, we hope that they're shared widely. I think what's also exciting about it is each one kind of focuses on a different topic, so a different issue, if you will, so homelessness or at-risk youth or, you know, senior citizens, Meals on Wheels programs being cut off, things like that. And so maybe one organization or a person out there is very interested in one specific subject, so they might be drawn into the series by that one video, and then maybe they'll stay for more and they'll see some other things. And I think the you know, the goal is that if people were to watch all of them, you know, they can see that across Illinois, you know, from Chicago to, you know, southern Illinois, urban, rural, you know, across ages, races, you know, everyone's being affected. And a lot of the effects are very similar and very severe.
And so you start in Charleston, Illinois, with Eastern Illinois University. And I was surprised watching this. One of the students say that 30% of the students at Eastern Illinois get MAP grant funding. And you kind of lay out everything that's happened over the university in this snapshot of this year. Why did you pick Eastern, Liz?
You know, Eastern had this really great campaign called Fund EIU, and there was a lot of really amazing student leaders that were part of it. And so I actually got connected to them through Young Invincibles, which is kind of a youth leader organization. And I just, you know, met some really awesome, awesome people. You know, Katie Witt is one of the main characters. She's a first-generation college student receiving the MAP grant, and she's student body president. You know, wouldn't be able to go to college without the MAP grant. You know, so I think, you know, I was just immediately attracted to the story as soon as I started talking to the people.
And then
this,
right. In the second episode, so that first one is about public education. The second one looks at at-risk youth, and you look particularly at a program in Berwyn, Youth Crossroads. And in it, it's the story of the clients, but then also, I think, very interestingly, the story of one of the employees. She, Jackie Wallen, and her husband both work at Youth Crossroads. I wanted to play just a little bit of how they've been affected, how what happened with them when her salary was cut in half in January 2016 until the stopgap budget was passed.
We started making some furniture on the side.
You know, we have mortgage, we have bills, we depleted our savings, you know. It's weird because, you know, I have a master's degree in counseling. I spent a lot of money on my education thinking that that would be able to, you know, help provide for our family and stuff. I spent no money on learning how to make tables. How long is this going to go on for? When do we just like throw in the towel and be like, okay, you know, we're done. We're going to go move somewhere else. We're going to do something else, which we don't want to do at all.
That's Jackie Wallen speaking on the new web series. It's called Stranded by the State. It's a collaboration between In These Times and Cartemquin Films. On the line with me is the director, producer, and editor of the series, Liz Carr, as well as the founder and artistic director of Cartemquin, Gordon Quinn. Liz, I think a lot of times when people are thinking about the budget impasse, they're thinking about the clients, and they also forget about the economic impact of the people who work at these agencies. I imagine that was an important point you wanted to get across in this short web series, in this episode.
Yeah, absolutely. And it'll be in other episodes as well, because that's just a huge part of the story. You know, across almost all of these agencies, there were huge layoffs. You know, they had no other choice, which also then led, of course, to people doing way more work and then just, you know, not being able to provide as kind of as good services, if you will, you know, as much services to people, you know, because there was less staff. And so, and of course, like this, like what happens if you're laid off? You know, you don't have a job anymore. Do you have to make the tough decision? Do you leave the state?
Or in their case, they start making furniture and selling furniture
right.
to,
yeah.
yeah. But can we right. also, can we also talk about Crossroads as an organization? Because you
yeah.
point out the work they do to help at-risk youth in Illinois. How does, for example, organizations like DCFS rely on a nonprofit like Crossroads?
Well, I think it's kind of like with Youth Crossroads and especially the CCBYS program, which is community-based youth services, and it's actually written into Illinois law. And they work really like hand in hand. And that, what CCBYS kind of does is it's almost like a first responder, if you will, or a specifically tailored program. So it's really weaving in counseling and family counseling. And so in, you know, if a kid is at a police station, they, you know, the police know the counselor at Youth Crossroads, and they can work together to find a program that will work for the child or the youth. So it's really offering a different way to really kind of create support systems. That are outside of DCFS.
Right. And you make the point that without it, how much does this end up costing taxpayers when these programs get cut?
Right. I mean, so what happens is, you know, all of these programs that I'm profiling are incredibly cost effective for taxpayers. You know, for the CCBYS program, it costs about $1,800, $1,900 per year per youth. And, you know, not to say that this would happen to every youth that wouldn't be in this program, but if you're in juvenile justice housing, that's about $100,000 a year. DCFS residential placement is about $100,000 a year. You know, so the price difference, the cost is so great. So even if you don't look at it from a human aspect, obviously you want this youth to thrive in life. But even outside of that, it's just incredibly cost effective. And across the board, you know, these programs are cost effective. You know, people, if you cut down on preventative services, it's not a guarantee, obviously, don't want to say that, but people end up, there's a higher incarceration rate, more emergency, you know, hospitalization or emergency room kind of visits, you know, nursing homes, depending on your age group, you know, and what group it is. So, I mean, it's just, it's smart from a human perspective and then also from a cost-effective perspective.
Gordon, do you think that people in Illinois understand the web of nonprofits and social service agencies and all these independent groups and how much the state and taxpayers rely on them to help provide social services throughout the state? Do you think that people are getting that?
You know, I think that's part of what we hope, and we that people will start to see these short pieces, and that they'll, you know, that they'll have a statewide influence, both by being on the web, and we're even trying to see if there's the possibility to get them on some of the more local stations downstate, because by and large, people don't have a sense of that, and I think that's one of the big challenges around government. You know, there's all this rhetoric about attacking government, and yet everybody virtually in the state depends on different kinds of government services and government activities. And when you take those away, and particularly when you take them away in the kind of arbitrary and disorganized plan of not having a budget, it creates tremendous inefficiencies and other kinds of costs. So it's, you know, we hope that this is one small drop in trying to make everyday people aware of the role that state government plays in their lives. It has huge consequences.
Well, and Gordon, I know you often talk about the impact that documentary films can have and filmmaking can have. And I should also add a congratulations to you with Kartemquin, you guys celebrating a big anniversary this year. Congratulations.
Thanks.
You know, as you think about that, I wonder what impact has this series had on you when you've been watching these episodes? What has it made you realize about Illinois and where we're at right now?
Well, you know, in many ways, I mean, we've made films about homelessness, we've made films about seniors, we've made films about you know, education, but so I think I'm pretty sophisticated about these areas. And yet many of the things that Liz is profiling are like these kind of other organizations, the not-for-profit sector, these places that have state contracts that even I didn't know about. It's like, wow, that's a terrific program. You know, we have a major film called The Homestretch about youth homelessness and exactly what that program is trying to address, which is keeping kids from either falling into homelessness or falling into some other inappropriate place within the social service area, you know, it was like, oh, wow, there are programs like that. So I think, you know, it's hopefully we're going to be able to get a fairly large audience for these things and that people will start to share them on social media and that kind of stuff.
We just have about a minute left, guys, but I can't help but ask, you know, you've talked about the fast turnaround of doing this. I wonder, Liz, when you started this, did you still think that we would be 3 weeks into December and be maybe yet again at a situation where we're not going to have the stopgap funding is going to end and we're not going to have a real budget in a couple of weeks?
Unfortunately, I kind of did, which is sad. I mean, part of it is, you know, it was pretty much stated that they were waiting until the general election to really kind of bring up the topic again. Unfortunately, there doesn't appear to be much movement. You know, I think it's also like what I want the series to do beyond, you know, I sincerely hope we get a budget and these services are funded very quickly. But I think there's a certain evergreen quality to this because you know, budgets have been, what I'm hearing from all these agencies is that budgets have been cut year to year to year to year for a very long time. And so they were already to the bone, and then this budget crisis is a catastrophe.
Yeah.
But I think even if the budget is fully funded, we need to look back even a little further and say...
And sorry, Liz, I'm afraid we're out of time there, but thanks for that thought. We're going to share all of these online so everyone can see them. Thanks to Liz Carr, Gordon Quinn. You've been listening to The 21st. Have a great day.